Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquires Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquires Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquires Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquiresfunds.com.
Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
And we're live. It's Tuesday, May 12th, 10:30 a.m. Pacific, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 5:30 p.m. UTC coordinated time. What's happening, fellas?
Not much, just stuck in a closet.
In Florida.
That's right. Here for the foreseeable future, this would be the background. I thought it was funnier than blurring it, so here we are.
It is funnier than blurring it. How about you,
Jake,
JT?
How you doing?
Doing well. A little rainy this morning, which is kind of different for California. It's been nice here. In fact, it's been kind of hot, so it's a nice change.
Yeah, it's always I'm up against the beach, so it's always overcast. Hey, we've got Cal. Kai? My eyes aren't good enough. Sorry, buddy. Tell us where you're from. I love going back through all of these and seeing where everybody's from. We got all four corners of the world.
Yeah, what is your fetish with that?
I just like seeing where everybody's dialing in. The future, man.
Okay.
What do you think? You think Fauci's going to come in and be one of the 10 today, or you think he's tied up? He's got that testimony, but I know he probably blocked off some time for this, don't you think?
He always does. He doesn't miss an episode.
Thanks, Tony.
Sometimes he's got to watch it afterwards.
One of the 10.
He probably listens to it while he's running. That makes more sense.
You think it makes him amped up?
Yeah, he likes it.
All right. Well, we should probably kick it off, huh?
Take it away, sir.
Whose turn is it? I think it might be mine.
Oh,
go ahead.
You go, JT.
All right. Welcome to Value After Hours with my esteemed co-hosts, Bill Brewster and Toby Carlyle. I'm your third wheel, Jake Taylor. Bill, what do you got for us this week?
Nothing. We're going to be talking about how confused I am.
So this is the Seinfeld segment, I guess.
How about you? I need some help thinking through what's going on. That's really what we're going to be talking about. I actually might ask Collective 10 to come together. Maybe we can get a hashtag going on Twitter or something and crowdsource some thoughts.
That's a good idea.
Toby, what do you got?
Yeah, I saw Cliff Asness had a third bite at the value cherry. Is systematic value investing dead? Spectacular paper. I read it in one go, and I've gone back and read it a few different times. I think it's very thorough. I think Cliff writes incredibly clearly, and I like the conclusion. So I'll be talking about that paper soon. What are you on, JT?
I've got some more vegetables for us. This is going to be a thing that I learned about recently that's called Baumol's cost disease.
Yeah, I've heard of that before.
Aren't we fighting enough disease right now? Just saying.
We've been fighting this one for a long time, and you probably didn't know it. So
that's fair. Those are the worst kind.
This is Value After Hours.
Starting right now.
Right now. You guys want to let me do Cliff first? Get Cliff.
Yeah, for sure.
Get Cliff out of the way.
So, please. I mean, a bunch of value people tuned in. We might as well give them the porn first.
Here's the value porn. Yeah. So great paper, worth checking out on AQR's little series, Cliff's Perspective. I don't know why they didn't call that Cliff's Notes. I feel like that was easy, low hanging fruit there.
But missed opportunity.
How about
for sure?
Going off a cliff.
That'd be pretty good.
That's him on Twitter. Shout out to Cliff. I do like you. Stay on Twitter.
He's one of the 10. He listens. He tunes in every week.
For sure he does.
Easily.
It just because he wants me talking my book about value makes everybody feel good. So all of the guys who are deep in value with me. So very comprehensive review of the value spread for various different value metrics, and he shows what it looks like over the full data set that they have. Every chart looks almost identical. Basically, what they show is that the spread is the widest now that it has ever been when you use the composite of all of those measures and you use the measures that AQR uses internally, which is something that I have seen too. When you apply all of the things that you would normally do, the internal quality, balance sheet health, profitability, so on, leverage, so on, you get these results now that basically show that the value spread is as wide as it has ever been, wider now than the GFC, wider now than the dot-com peak, which is kind of extraordinary to go back through this time again, given how recent the last peak was, only 20-something years ago. And then he sort of asks, he goes through and he asks all of these questions. Why? Has the world changed? So is it due to some sort of several very highly profitable monopolies that are skewing the results? He carves them out and still gets the same answer. So it's not a winner-take-all monopoly or tech phenomenon. Basically, he says all that's happening is we're paying more for some companies than we ever have in the past, and we're paying less for other companies than we have in the past. And so that's created this massive spread. The other thing that he looks at is inside each of those portfolios, is it due to some sort of deterioration in value stocks or some sort of like better quality in growth stocks than usual? So what you typically find is that value stocks are, at the time that you're buying them, they do look, they're not as good as the growthier story stocks in terms of their leverage and profitability and so on. But the question is, it's a mispricing question. You're not trying to find the best stock on the stock market. You're trying to find the most mispriced stock. And value is very, very mispriced at the moment. And particularly so when you look at, you break down the two portfolios on the basis of profitability and leverage, value's no worse than it normally is. The growthy stuff's no better than it usually is. It's just an unusual phenomenon. It's interesting that in 1999, and JT, you pointed this out, that the value stocks were actually better than the growth stocks in 1999.
So return on assets. Or for the cheapest decile, I think it was better return on assets across that segment than the most expensive, which is like... really pretty shocking, right?
Absolutely.
No, there were no returns, right? In the in 99 in the high decile,
there was less.
Right?
Yeah. And then the one of the other things he did that I just missed was he compares the most expensive stocks to the middle, to those in the middle, and runs that for the full data series, and then he compares the middle stocks to the cheapest and runs that for the full data series to see whether it's an expensive stock phenomenon or is this a cheap stock phenomenon? You know, which side of the alligator jaws are driving the spread? What he says that, which is something that I didn't expect to see, but it's actually the cheapest stocks. It's both. The spread is very wide on both sides, but it's the cheapest stocks are wider now, are cheaper relative to the middle than they were historically. And if I can square that up on an absolute basis, if you look at price to cash flow on the Fama French series, you get a similar answer that we've got. I think value is cheap all by itself. The spread is very, very wide. The final question that everybody wants answered is, when does it turn around? When does value start working again? Cliff didn't answer that question. Nobody can answer that question. He says that the odds are very good right now. Value is a very good strategy. So it's just a matter of kind of waiting. So nothing's really changed, I guess. It's just more food for my bias, which I love.
Yeah, one of the things they used in his report was I was curious about debt levels always with this, because I'm more an enterprise value type of guy. And he talked a little bit about that, but they used debt to book value, basically, book equity book value. And I would have liked to have seen something more in like of a cash flow type of coverage ratio comparisons over time. I'd be curious to see if that gave you a different answer as far as leverage ratios go.
Do you mean on an EV, could EV EBITDA or EV EBIT answer that question for you?
Yeah, EV to EBIT would answer that.
So Wes's website has that EV EBIT. You gotta to get into that website. It's you gotta scale a wall and swim through the moat. It's hard to get into. It's free and anybody can get into it. It's just hard to get into. The last time I checked, both of those EV EBITDA was sort of saying it's a 1999 type opportunity, and EV EBIT was like pretty close to that. It was at least a 2007 type opportunity.
When I looked at it last week, it was not as pronounced as 99 was. So you have sort of there's probably a little bit more debt, and then there's the assets are probably not as good as 99. So it makes it like a little bit less obvious to me, a little bit harder to really pound the table. But it's definitely, we're in the ballpark of where like, you could create some value gurus from that starting point.
Raining on my parade, JT. Almost, sorry, almost.
It's just like, it's pathological for me at this point.
Well, you got to. I mean, values let us down so many times. You got to be asking the hard questions here.
Try to.
I just need the inspiration to keep going.
That's fair.
I don't know where I stand on this. I guess if we... Like, let's go back and add back COVID, you know, like EBITDAC. You know, if but for COVID, I think I would be more willing to really bet on the data right now. And this is why the opportunities exist. I mean, I had sent out a tweet about the small value factor when I read Dan Rasmussen's piece. And I was like, I just don't know that that's the place you want to fish anymore. Like, not that there are not opportunities. There clearly are within the set. But as far as a factor goes, it's like 15 years of underperformance. I mean, at some point, you got to kind of ask what's going on here. And I guess that what my perception, and this is fraught with bias and why I'm running my portfolio the way I am, but my perception is just that access to capital and size are so important right now that running to that sector of the market was certainly rational in March. I mean, whether or not it still is sort of a different question. But I think that as a basket, it would not shock me to see that basket outperform. Certainly at some point, it's going to just rip. I just don't know how to handicap the odds within a particular stock. I mean, it's obviously everything is a situation dependent, but man, small scares me right now. I mean, just because I think the path of the outcomes is so wide that the ability to raise the liquidity is so important. And I just don't know. I know that the natural, like, if I'm arguing with myself, I'd be like, yeah, dude, well, when's that ever not been the case? And I get that. But, like, right now, it just feels scary.
I mean, that's a pretty good argument.
Which is probably why it exists. Yeah. A major bifurcation.
That's a pretty good argument for it.
Yeah.
You know, if I look where's the opportunity set now? Like, the top end of the market, tech has just run as far. Not as far as it can go, obviously. I'm not saying it can run as far as it can go. Who knows? I'd never be that mad to say that it's run as far as it can go, but gee, it's run a long way relative to the fundamentals. And value sort of just has kind of been falling behind further and further, particularly small value. At some stage, the opportunity just becomes so great that you're kind of compelled to bet on some mean reversion. Like, I would have said that bet was pretty pronounced a year ago, but I think that the bet is, it's just more pronounced now. Who would have thought that we'd get to like close to 90, whether we're through it or not, we're close to the peak of the last time that value had a really spectacular run.
Yeah. I mean, I fully understand all the psychological reasons that what I just said is stupid. I just think that it's, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It's
you can wait
it's
for
all
it to start
situation
working.
Situation dependent.
You can wait for it to start working. That's one thing that I've like. I don't think you have to be. I don't think you necessarily have to be betting on the way down in the factor right now. I think you could wait for the turn because I think that it's going to work for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I think that's arguably fair. And I know, like, personally, when I look at mistakes, when I look at the mistakes that I made, I'm often early on something, and I think that I have not, like, I'm so focused on trying to, like, not bottom tick, but like get a deal that I find myself buying, and then stuff immediately goes down, you know, 10-20%. And it's like, oh man, if I had just sort of like forced a little bit of patience, not that you can pick the bottom, but the other side, it's not like something re-rates 100% on you over day, unless it's like Roku, but that's sort of a different issue.
Premature accumulation.
Yes.
Happens to the best of us.
Yeah.
What's your concern there, JT? You're kind of, you didn't want to fully endorse my wait and see.
I just think that the real returns are made, I think, like Buffett says about, you know, waiting until you hear the robins for spring. It's kind of too late. Until it gets all cleared up. I guess when it comes down to it, the bifurcation that we saw in 99 was this story around, you know, .com and new economy, and really having like lower cost structures because you don't need brick and mortar, et cetera. And probably all true, right? It just like took longer. Well, that was the how quick it was going to happen was mispriced, I think. So you were able to buy a lot of stuff that was going to last for a long time and was earning better than their counterparts, at least at that juncture. Fast forward to today, similar bifurcation. But now is the question, is it mispriced in the consequences of COVID and the damage that's being done to these businesses versus the ones that are holding up? And is that mispriced at this point? I don't know. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. As it's not as easy, I guess. I guess it was probably hard then, like when the new economy seemed to be working. And yeah, of course, all these dinosaurs are going dead. Like this was a meteor that hit. Right. I guess you could say the same thing right now about all the stuff that's in a value basket, you know, energy, retail, travel, a meteor hit, right? These are all dinosaurs that are going to die. This game's not easy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So that I think is, I can, my perception of how value works and where I like to fish is like, energy, I don't know anything about EMP. I would get destroyed trying to pick, you know, like junior oil companies or some shit like that. Forget that noise. But like energy infrastructure assets, I can get my head around that. And I can get my head around why that's a long duration asset. And I can get my head around why the future probably looks a lot more rosy than people are contemplating right now. And like that's a way that I can understand like value, right? Or travel. I have a bias and have bet on and will continue to probably bet on that people will come back to travel. Like I understand searching for really good assets in beaten up sectors. I am less, at least running a discretionary portfolio, I am less certain that I can pull up like small value as a factor and then go through and pick the winners out of that subset. I guess that's sort of where I'm coming from when I say what I say. And like, I'm sure there is some listener being like, he doesn't understand that the entire reason that value works is because no one wants to buy it. Like, I'm telling you, I get it. But I just, you know, that's where how my mind works. So like I've accumulated some exposure that's tangentially related to energy over this time period. I've accumulated a lot of travel related exposure. So that's sort of how I'm trying to play like value, quote unquote.
Would you say that that bottom up in that kind of a like stock picking makes it really hard to buy the anything out of the basket of small cap value, and that you're probably better served not thinking about it bottom up and more making a broader bet kind of shotgun, that some of these are going to work out better than the ones that don't work out. I'm going to capture that asymmetry, and that I'm just betting on the entire population, not bottom up research of like, well, this one's really crap, I'm going to throw that out.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I get it from like a quant basket approach. It makes sense to me in that type of approach. It just doesn't make that much sense to me, like, for me to go in and pick discretionarily. I mean, I don't deny there's some great opportunities there, right? But it's just, how am I going to find them and know and all that is sort of the questions that I ask.
I think those are legitimate concerns. I think that's where you go. That's where you run into trouble when you try to discretionarily pick out of some of those more beaten up names. Although there are definitely folks out there who are doing it pretty well. Like, I don't think Ian Cassell, I think I name check him every single time I record one of these things, but impressive returns. I think that he's like, I don't know if he would characterize himself necessarily as a value guy, though. He might say that he's more growthy, and but he's certainly doing that, picking them out name by name.
Yeah, so like, here's a plug for his service. I mean, I have been trying to think about what is a good, I've been trying to figure out, like, when will I have the time to research a microcap to submit to that network group, right? Because Microcap Club is something that I want to get involved in. I mean, I do want more focus on microcap, and my network group is really focused. We're mostly focused on media and experience. I mean, that's most of the conversations that I'm having day to day. I'm not in the microcap network, and I would like to work on expanding my network that way, because I do think that you can find great ideas and stuff, but I think that you cultivate them in a similar way that I cultivate what I do, and that's like talking the ideas with a network of people. So that's why I'm not inclined to just like pull up a small factor or a small value factor and then just go through the list.
It won't work. It took me a decade to get from when you do a back test and you get the output from the back test to like, the output from the back test is garbage. It takes a long time to get a back test that delivers a list of names that you would actually buy as a sane individual that then also tests well. That is really the challenge of the process, because the first time you run it, it just pulls up all this stuff that has somehow fooled the screen. Like, it's just through there because it's got some obvious problem with it, and it's not investable.
You're like data fitting or something like that with your first back test?
All the horses have broken legs and the model doesn't know it.
Yeah. There's something like, there's genuinely something wrong with it. Like, it's just for whatever reason, so if you use EV EBITDA and you pull up some financials, you'll see that it's just wrong. Like, you need to be doing those other things, some little quality cash flow checks, various other things to get to a point where it produces a portfolio that is sensible.
And that you could psychologically hold.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that's half of it.
That's the challenge.
Even if it was not the best, even if maybe it was a suboptimal return than just picking the pure flat, whatever it showed, the fact that you couldn't handle it and ride the horse to the finish line,
that's
matters
a lot of it.
Also.
That's a lot of it. That's underappreciated how difficult that is to do, that you really have to believe it. I mean, people are seeing that with value as an entire strategy. Like, just, it's hard to believe in it given how badly it has performed. It's hard to see what needs to happen for it to start working again. Even I would struggle to explain to somebody why I think it'll start working again. I'm sort of fortunate to have invested through a period of time in the early 2000s when it did work very, very well. And so I have seen it work. And I've also seen the flip side of that, which is that even very high quality companies with very high rates of growth, if they get extremely expensive, they'll just go sideways for a decade. That's what happened in the early 2000s. There were great companies in there. Things that were darlings in the late 1990s that just didn't do anything for 10 years. And the underlying, the fundamentals were great. Fundamentals were great every time. Just, it's not like this thing now where you put on Microsoft at 2.8% free cash flow yield and it goes up. You put on Microsoft at a 2.8% free cash flow yield, the sales go up 30%, and now it's a 3 0.5% cash flow yield and it hasn't gone anywhere. That can happen.
Yep.
But your 10-year is only 0.8%. So
that's true.
In theory.
That's
who
true.
Who knows how high it could go.
But is it, you know, so this is the thing, right? The direction of the interest rates is probably more important than the...
I say that whoever just pulled their eyeballs out.
But that's a fair question.
But I am also half serious.
That's a fair question. Probably the direction of the interest rates is more important than the absolute level of interest rates, right? Everybody just adjusts to the absolute level, but it's the change that maybe we go negative. I don't know what happens then. That's through the looking glass. Who knows what happens in that scenario?
I was thinking about that today. I was like, man, you know, you could really get valuations going nuts in the negative rate environment. I mean, people almost certainly put a floor under it, but who knows?
I mean, it's infinite, right? It's infinite at zero. Like, what happens when it goes through zero? Who knows?
It's just so tough to handicap the odds because there's a lot of money, and I don't do this kind of work, but like the incremental flows, right? If you are if you have negative rates out there, what do you do if you're a pension manager? Like, you just have to plow in.
You just assume 8%. You just keep on putting 8% into your model.
PE, yeah. VC, who are going to mark to whatever you need them to market to.
Mark to model.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, very hard question. I mean, the answer is probably you raise taxes and then, you know, try to actually fund that way. But that's not fun for anyone.
Do you look at Japan? Has Japan gone negative? Like, when did Japan get actually negative?
I don't know, but Greek Fire on Twitter, that dude, he roasted Trump today, was saying if everybody
negative's
else
good.
Has negative rates, like we should enjoy the gift too. And he was like, yeah, because those continents and countries
they've all done well.
Real well. Like, that's really who we want to be.
That's funny, right? It's not. It's so hard because I have no idea. Macro's too hard for me. I've got no idea.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, good. I'm going to get into more of it because I'm going to talk about how confused I am. And, you know, what is so difficult to square right now as a human for me, right? Maybe I just have like a pea brain, but I watched Buffett and I think I'm not the only one that's confused. Is what, like, I get that people are saying, look at the last quarter and look at how some of these tech companies grew last quarter. And I get that the economy has not stopped, right? But let's think through, you know, how quick can this employment come back? And in a world where certain policy proposals are at least being floated where school may or may not happen next year. I mean, it's not, you know, that's not like common, but it's out there. In a world where you can't hire fundamentally enough people because your restaurant can't get to the capacity that is required, in a world where United is saying, hey, in October, once this payment or payroll protection loan rolls off, we may decline by 30% the amount of pilots that we have. How does CapEx on the business side, like, how does that ramp? And what are all the multiplier effects of all this velocity coming in? Like, I have no fucking clue how we make it out of this okay, other than, like, blind faith. It's just hard, man. And I don't want to be like, I really want to be careful not to get this, Jake. I like that. You got your crying emoji. I really don't want to get into some like bear rant, and I want to be rational about it. And I said on Twitter, like, it's not impossible for me to be optimistic here, but man, is it hard. And it's really hard when I read, like, I've gotten privy to a couple real estate conferences, like Barry Sternlicht. He is, I think you would be hard pressed to qualify him as bullish. Sam Zell, like all the OGs are like really worried right now. And
it's because they're old, mate.
I mean, that's
need some gunslingers. Need some young gunslingers to come in here and really mess it up for you.
Yeah, well, that's the knock, right? Like, they don't understand how the world works now. But it's like, I don't know, man. You want to, I mean.
You need to go truck, get a couple of young guys who aren't scared, come in and just rip that $7 billion up for you.
To be fair, like, I think it was March 12th or 13th or something. I said, like, I think that there are certain things that are cheap. But the world has changed a lot since then. I mean, we have had quite a rally in a lot of stuff. So now it's not as cheap as it was, to say the least. So I don't know. I mean, how do you guys think through that? How do you even start to build the thoughts?
So I think if you're going to be listening to other people in times of high uncertainty, you probably want to err towards the older people, all other things equal, because one, they've seen more things, and the fact that they've survived enough to make it to this time period at least tells you something about the resilience of how they've handled things. So if I know nothing else about them, I think you probably want to like favor the old lion a little bit, because you know that he got here. Like he's stood up to some tests to get here. So when guys like Zell and Buffett are concerned, I think that should make everyone scratch their head a little bit and maybe back off, you know, the animal spirits that they might be feeling. But
yeah,
maybe,
well,
that's
why
just
don't
me.
We throw Malone in there, right? And
sure. Pretty much, you know, anybody who's been around for a while. Have you seen anyone older who is bullish right now?
No, not really. I mean, I'm sure there are some people. I mean, in the middle of March,
throw that to the crowd.
John Rogers had come out and he said that he thought it was a generational buying opportunity. I mean, there are a lot, but again, March is a lot different than right
for
now.
Like three days.
Yeah, I mean, things changed,
sure,
right?
Generation.
So, and I also want to be really careful with myself of not being like too focused on short-term fears and forgoing long-term thinking. But the way that the Lollapalooza of all this and how it could unravel on the downside has a very legitimate chance of impairing long-term growth. It's not just like a short-term quarter concern, right? It's
dividend
like
yield. Dividends will be back to where they were by 2027. So it's not impaired forever. It's just like 7 years.
Yeah, that hurts.
Long-term growth, I'm worried about the asset value of things already in the ground. I mean, more or less, is anything growing?
I said this last week, but I'll say it again. I was pretty nervous. Not nervous, but I'm like realistic to negative probably at the moment. And when I saw Buffett hadn't done anything, that really sent a shot of adrenaline into my body and ruined that entire weekend for me. And I've sort of slowly forgotten about it, so I don't feel quite so nervous anymore. But when the greatest to ever do it is cashed up, and all he does through something like that is sell down, if you don't take notice of that and just like consider what that means a little bit, then I think you're an idiot.
I mean, I sort of agree. You know, and it's like I'm not like in a debate with people, but I float Starbucks on Twitter. It's a brand that I know. It's a brand that I like. I do love Starbucks.
Starbucks will be fine.
To me.
They've proven that you can sell terrible coffee and still make lots of money.
It's an experience, Toby.
But that's not. But the issue isn't, are they going to be fine, right? The issue is, what does fleet-wide throughput look like, and how long? And like, you know, I mean, you're paying over $100 billion for that company, so that implies some rosy stuff. I mean, how many companies in history have ever hit $100 billion EV? I get you got ROIC,
Tesla.
That it's a long-term grower. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Just all the greats.
Fucking Tesla. Man, Elon Musk is acting a fool right now, huh?
He's got just a new saying. Baby. That's what happens.
Is it? What do you do if you're that kid? I'm not trying to pick on that kid. That kid's just as innocent as any other kid. But what do you do if that's your name?
So I've seen some explanation that
you gotta go change it.
Well, the X translates to... they could, like, they're clearly having fun with everybody, right? The X translates to Kai... The AE.
I think he said Ash or something like that on Rogan's podcast.
I saw somebody broke it down, like somebody who can code broke it down. They said basically it's Kyle. Kyle, pronounced Kyle. And so probably that's what the name is. It's just, but they're just messing with everybody because why wouldn't you?
Damn it, Kyle.
Yeah. He must not watch lots of South Park. Maybe he does, probably.
Well, it sounds like we're not getting closer to the answer. You know, I don't know. I just think there's so many, like, there's just so many variables right now that when you get to, like, the Charlie Munger Lollapalooza stuff, you're fighting a virus. I think politics are starting to creep into how people actually see that. You've got an election year. There's, like, signaling that's impacted by that. The freaking bundle, I just saw that Satellite, shout out to my man Francisco Oliveira for sending this to me. It looks like Satellite growth, it looks for the quarter was down 14% pay TV subscriber growth, so that's not great. You got no sports. Cable news is got every incentive in the world to get as sensational as possible to get people tuned in. Like,
you got The Last Dance. I started watching it. I'm three episodes in. They haven't mentioned the most important player on the team. I'm kind of amazed.
Luke Longley.
Yeah.
I can't believe you got there before I did.
He's not the most important, but certainly a good glue guy. Certainly a glue guy.
That man's a national treasure.
That may be. We'll take Jordan. You can have him. Luke Longley. Good for him. So anyway, I don't know. It's just like one of those scenarios where I just think, man, you could get I think that's why Buffett's monologue was so what's the right word for his
somber
monologue?
Chilling.
Yeah, somber, yeah. And the reflexiveness, like we talked earlier about the reflexive nature of this virus and how people react. People, if you go through an extended period of stagnation or like just unemployed, I mean, the amount of optimism that is embedded in cap rates and multiples right now, it can fall apart. And if it falls apart, it can stay that way for a long time.
So, Toby, how do you square all of that scary stuff with, you know, Cliff's paper and like, shit, time to push your chips in if you're a value guy?
Well, that's what 1999, 2000 would have looked like too. I think, here's one implementation of it, right?
I don't think so, man.
You didn't have the same type of economic scare in 99.
Yeah, like 30 million people unemployed, that's not 99.
Well, it's not going to be 30 million.
Cocaine-induced tech rally.
It's not going to be 30 million, though. Like, it's 30 million while everybody's furloughed. That'll come back a bit. It's still going to be very, very bad. I'm not saying that it's not very, very bad. I'm saying it's not 30 million. But I do think that this is...
How do you think through that? That's the question.
It's a dot-com mashed up with the GFC. We're having them both at the same time. So you can go through and you can look at what happened in both of those things. And I'll tell you what I would do. I would implement a long, short value strategy that gets long a whole lot of really undervalued stuff and gets short a whole lot of really expensive, junky stuff. That is me talking my book, but that is exactly what I would do. I thought about it before I launched it. Like I'm doing what I think is going to work in the very near term, and I think it's going to work for a long, long time.
That's fair.
That makes sense. That is a rational answer, and... a good way to plug what you do.
Gracias.
Do you want to do
your veggies, JT? Save the veggies
for last. Is
anyone
even hungry anymore? I don't know. Do we get squeezed out again down into like a 2-minute segment?
No.
We're going long. You know what? I've heard people don't mind long, so let's go long.
All right. So this
the length does matter.
I'm not going there. This 1960s economist named William Baumol. He came up with this idea that you start with this thought that imagine like a Beethoven quartet performing Beethoven's symphony. And over the last 200 years, that has not had any gains in productivity. It takes the same amount of time, the same amount of training, the same instruments, the same number of people to perform that quartet. Four, probably, right?
Damn, that's a great joke.
In general, productivity has occurred in much more in things like manufacturing and places where it's not humans doing some kind of special, like, you know, required service or labor. Okay. So what you end up happening is really like all of our material wealth in society comes from increases in productivity. So imagine that I said, Bill, I need you to go dig a giant hole, and I'm going to give you a big like earth mover to do it. Like, how much could you get done in an amount of time? Versus Toby, I'm giving you a spoon and you have to move the same amount of dirt, and it's going to take you like, you know, years to do the same amount. Well, we are all wealthier based on the capital structures that we have, based on the training that we get, based on our the processes and procedures and technologies that we figure out how to do things to achieve our aims. Well, in the service industry in general, it's much harder to get those same kind of productivity gains because it requires a human to do that, and they can't all of a sudden do things, you know, 100 times faster than they could. So you imagine things like education, like grading papers. I can't do that at 10x the speed if I'm actually reading it and, you know, writing notes to a student.
That can help you though, right?
It can, yeah. But eventually, yeah. So nursing, for instance, like applying a bandage on someone, like we can't get nurses to do that at 100x speed somehow. Even things like government, you know, police officers, firefighters, you know, some of their tools can improve, but in general, you know, going to the DMV and processing a new license application has had no productivity gains, right? And Baumol predicted in the 1960s that we would see the service sectors, basically the costs of the services rising, because they still have to compete with the manufacturers for the labor pool. Like, otherwise no one goes and does those services. So he predicted that we would see huge price increases in things like education, government, healthcare. And, you know, part of me being sympathetic to Austrian or, you know, libertarian tendencies, I would look at those type of things and say, oh, well, those are the things that government's pretty heavily involved in, and that's why they kind of suck and why the price has gone up and there hasn't been material improvement. And the things like apparel and computers and TVs have all gotten much cheaper in the last, you know, 20 years. And I've attributed that to like, oh, well, that's the free market at work. Like, that's, you know, good things happening. Like, that's competition. And maybe that was a little bit of an uninformed viewpoint, given Baumol's cost disease, that it's more the service versus the productivity of manufacturing and the gains that we can get there that are actually driving some of these results. So, any comments at this point before I tell you what kind of some of my takeaways were from this idea?
I have some thoughts, but I don't want to derail you. I want to keep going just in case you answer them.
Well, no. I think he just asked you for your thoughts, though.
Well, one is that I think that the healthcare issue is, I think that's an interesting one, because there's an enormous amount of technology that makes healthcare so much more, the analysis is so much more penetrating than it used to be, because we've got MRI machines, we've got testing and things like that we can do. We've got better drugs, we've got better procedures, we've got robotic procedures, we've got, like, the technology in there is amazing. And I don't think that the US is sort of unique globally in that it has an enormous spend and the results in terms of life expectancy aren't keeping up with the spend or aren't keeping up with the rest of the world. And I think personally that the problem is that you have this separation of, you know, the person who gets the service doesn't pay for the service. That goes to the insurance company. And then they bill your employer. And then, so you, at no stage is there any cost discipline or any shopping. And when you look at, for example, when you look at cosmetic procedures, which don't have the access to that same infrastructure, cosmetic procedures have got rapidly cheaper. You can get, you know, you drive around the streets here, you can get botulism, that's what it is, like the botox shots for, like, that they're ridiculously cheap now. You basically walk in off the street and get your shots done.
Yeah, all the people on Netflix is Too Hot to Handle got all their work done with just $5,000 of winnings. They also look like it, to be fair. Some of those girls ruin themselves. Anyway, I digress. I would also add that on education, it's like these are really tough issues for me because, like, with education, I think that we should let students declare bankruptcy and get out of
it's
education
crazy
debt,
that they can't do
and
that.
then you would have less incentive to lend money to it, and then you couldn't, like, gouge people. So I just think it's a little bit tougher. And with the TVs and stuff, globalization, it's so easy to just go to the cheapest country to make it. That services you can't do that with. So I don't know. I don't have a good sense. But I do sort of viscerally agree that service productivity is a little bit slower. Like, if I think back to when I was at the bank, the ability to roll out new software and processes within a big organization, it's just slow. Maybe manufacturing's the same, but I don't know. I guess you get locked into how you do things.
I think education is such a huge opportunity to really do something spectacular where you could have, you know, so there's that masterclass. I don't know if you have seen that, but that's kind of an interesting approach where I don't see why you can't find the best single presenter of each subject in the nation or globally and then put them together into some sort of Netflix type lecture series, and then you gamify it the way that Khan Academy has, and then you have.
I'm going to give a shout out right now and hope that the three of us can get some sort of access. But in practice, have you seen what they're building for investing?
No, is it good?
They've got really good interviews. If that guy continues down this path, he's going to have a sweet service. It's not masterclass because it's
same
just
idea.
Interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, but it's interviews with old CEOs, industry execs. It's good stuff.
That's all masterclasses. It's just interviews, and then they've been kind of systematic about the way that they've asked the questions and put it together into some sort of order. Like that, each one is different. I think that when you see when you see Thomas Keller cook eggs, you're like, I want to go and eat in that guy's restaurant. I don't want to cook eggs like that. Which is kind of I thought that was an interesting insight. I think if you see a lot of people who are very good at what they do what they do, you realize that really there's a level of mastery there that's taken decades to kind of get to that point. And it's not something that you can just pick up and be good at having watched a series like that. But I do think that...
I don't know. I'm like Steph Curry now, just watching him
just
shoot every time.
Draining three-pointers from anywhere. I think that if we had independent testing centers that could verify that you can go in and take a test and pass all of the things that you've been taught, that would be a much better system than you go to Harvard and you get some specialized teaching there. I just think there's a better way of doing it that would be much, much cheaper that would solve that problem.
So that would be technology kind of disrupting, turning what was previously a human, very involved thing into more of a manufacturing almost type of scaling.
Makes it sound dirty when you say it like that, but that would be the idea.
Dirty in a good way. So one of my takeaways was that our fight to not have robots replacing us for our jobs, I think, is actually probably a bad idea. And we should embrace the robots who can come and do some of these service jobs for us, and have that productivity gain to grow the pie enough to where that would be a way of fighting some of Baumol's cost disease.
You're going to end up the first quasi-Austrian libertarian that also supports UBI.
I think there's people...
Right, robots are going to do it all, and then we'll just collect the dividends.
That's Marxism. That's literally Marx's utopia is the robots do all of the jobs and we go to the beach. That sounds great.
It doesn't sound bad. It's awesome in a book.
Who builds the robots?
Don't worry about
robots. Yeah, exactly.
Look, I'm coming up with strategy. That's tactics. That's somebody else's job.
Yeah, that's fair.
So one of my other takeaways was that, you know, a lot of the new jobs that were added in the last 10 years, I think, were primarily service-based jobs. And that that COVID perhaps impacts those more than normal. Like, you know, you can't go get a haircut. You can't, you know, get your nails done or go to a restaurant.
Turns out you don't need a haircut.
I beg to differ.
I'm going for 3 more inches here. I'm going to really grow
longer
it
hair too.
Because screw it.
Good one. So, if you imagine that,
it took me a second.
Our profit.
Three more. I'm not looking to double things, Toby. Come on, that's greedy.
Speaking of
double. My mom is listening.
Oh, God. The right now, we're at about like 2x profit margins for S&P 500 over compared to historical mean. Gosh, you have to imagine that if we back off of some of this globalization because of COVID, which I think is probably a very rational response and something we could expect to see, it has to impact profit margins, right? Like, we can't.
I don't know, man.
That's loser talk. That's loser talk. We're going straight through this.
No, I'm not trying to go there with you, but like, I've been thinking about, so like, OMAB, O-M-A-B, it's a Mexican airport, you know, conglomerate, or not conglomerate, but they own airports in Mexico. Something that I was thinking about is like, if we onshore more stuff to North America, I could see that it helps enough people that, I am unclear what happens. Let me just put it that way.
So I would agree that it would help people, which they're increasing your productivity, but then some of that has to be shared with the workers and their wages coming up, right? So yeah. I think, and also too, as government as a thing gets more expensive because it's more cost-based or it's more service-based, don't we have to have higher corporate taxes again at some point?
Yes, I do think that's a fact.
Capital's had a really good run against labor.
Yeah, they have.
And this is
for what, like 50 years or something?
This is about as stretched as it's ever got before. So
yeah, I agree with that.
I think, I personally think the Fed has a lot to do with that. If you pump up asset prices, that's what happens. You set interest rates too low, you get bloated asset prices.
Yeah, man, and the thing that sucks about that shit is like the people that don't understand the game and are just like savers get just fucked. You know what I mean? Like, what do you
earn on your cash? There's no savers anymore. There's no savers anymore. You can't be a saver and survive.
That's a problem.
You've had to move out the risk curve. The Fed loves taking people right up the risk curve.
That said, something that I do think that we have talked about, and I don't necessarily – I don't know how I feel about this, but the way that we've talked about, like, companies are so lean and they run optimally, like, levered and stuff like that, I do agree that you're giving up fragility, but you are getting a benefit in velocity of money going through the system. I mean, it is more efficient. I don't know
– Isn't velocity of money like – isn't it flatlining?
Well, yeah, it has been. It has been. But what I'm saying is, if you then say, well, we should just accumulate all this cash on the balance sheet, you should see velocity implode, right? Because, I mean, like, if you reduce buybacks and you just accumulate cash, if corporations become huge savers, that's not good.
That's a Japan-type scenario, right, where they just load up the balance sheet and they've got the interlocking holdings, so there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, and you're just, like, trapped in there.
Yeah.
Toss in your questions, guys.
I don't know if I'd buy that... I know that like consumption it's a good thing for us, and people like to make that argument like, oh, I'm stimulating the economy by going and racking my credit card up, which is kind of what corporate America did. I don't know if I buy that. Like, pulling forward demand from the future through credit doesn't necessarily to me sound like the smartest behavior.
No, that sounds like it's that you might run out of runway.
Levered
pretty
equity, bro. You just,
I know.
It keeps.
You're so right until you're wrong.
Yeah, I'll send you a DCF. You'll get it.
Fair enough. All right, it's Q&A time.
Yeah, throw out the questions.
I didn't mean to be so vague with my topic, but like, I've just been sitting around thinking about like how to even think through it.
You got it. That's just a market. I think it's a good question. I think it's good. That's what everybody's thinking about all the time.
Talking.
The thing is, yeah, I'm just like trapped in this towel closet, terrified. That's really why I'm in here. I just can't open the doors.
It's agoraphobia.
But like, you know, if you just argue, forget about numerically risk reward. What's the upside here? Like, really, 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 what's the upside? And then I can construct a pretty terrifying downside. And I think you usually can do that, but, like, I don't know. Sometimes I just have to get my head rational right now, and I'm just, like, really struggling to stay in my brain and not in my fear, if that makes sense.
My fear lives in my brain.
It's mine, too.
I got a question. What do you think of developed markets ex-US underperforming? Market cap for the NASDAQ 100 now exceeds the market cap for the MSCI World ex-US 1000.
Duh, because America is the best. Next.
Well, no, it's saying that that developed world that's not the US is done worse than EM. Is that what it's saying?
No, it's saying that the NASDAQ 100 now has a market cap bigger than the MSCI World, excluding the US, because the US is in the MSCI World. So the NASDAQ 100 is bigger than the rest of the world, which is just like that's fan mag is bigger than everything else in the world. Which
all the little bullshit countries.
Dude, it's the same.
Fan mag is some businesses. I just think we all have to acknowledge that. And like that matters. They're worth a lot.
They're great businesses. That's absolutely right. It's the same phenomenon. It's the value phenomenon. It's the reverse market cap. So the equal weight index is underperforming market cap weight index. Big is outperforming small. Cats are mating with dogs. I don't know. The world is upside down. Things are going on.
I sort of studied Europe a little bit, and to any European listeners, if I say anything, you know, shoot me a Twitter message and tell me I'm wrong. But like when I was studying Ryanair, man, the amount of regulations over there and like just how hard it must be to piece together that whole union and just how it doesn't seem efficient. And I know that we're the same with states, but we're not. Like it is a structural advantage. So I don't know. They're, as a group, I could see the U.S. outperforming. They obviously have certain incredible companies, but I'm not sure. I don't know.
This kind of reminds me, though, of that. There's a little graphic that shows, like, I think it's each decade, and it shows, like, what were the best performers and, like, what's the narrative at the time. And it was, like, 1980s, Japan, Inc., taking over the world. And all those Japanese companies are, like, the best. 1990s, it was like .com, and it's like Cisco, Microsoft at that point, like a million things. And the narrative was, you know, it's a new economy. 2000s, you get into, I don't know, like Countrywide or some bullshit narrative there. And now it's like, this is, you know, Fang basically. This is the time it's different, and this is when, like, the narrative is finally completely right. And
Munger said it was a lot different, right? At Daily Journal, he said, like, this is nowhere near the Nifty 50. And I do think that, like, these really good tech businesses are really awesome. I mean, and they are worth a lot. Now, you know, whether or not they're worth what people are paying, that's sort of a different issue. But we as a country are producing some pretty impressive stuff.
That's all true.
GMO is a great resource for this stuff. I like what they write. They tend to be a little bit too into commodities for me all the time, but I do really like what they write.
It's only because commodities have been losing.
I know, but it's like,
if commodities start working, you'll say, wow, those guys are really smart.
No, I'm not like resulting. I just don't, I don't understand what constricts commodity supply. And to me, that's exactly the game there.
I got another question here. This is Howard Marks' memo is already the same to me, so I don't actually know which Howard Marks memo we're talking about here. But any thoughts on Howard Marks' latest memo?
I haven't read it.
No,
so
neither
have I. I've read the last. Well, I read him intermittently. Sorry, Mr. Marks.
I didn't read his last. Oh, he definitely listens. I don't think I read the last one. Whatever he put out in March, I thought was interesting. I thought that was one of the first memos he actually said something in a long, long time. He's another one that's not exactly bullish, though he never really is, except when he's selling out to Brookfield and screwing his shareholders.
Too soon, Bill. Too soon.
Anybody who can read Brookfield's accounts, drop me a line and tell me how you do it, because I've had a go. I've had lots of other folks who I know and respect with PhDs in accounting have a go. Can't figure it out.
Dude, they are getting blown up right now because I guess they're lending. I mean, I don't follow the whole complex, but I guess they're lending to certain entities to get other entities paid. You know, clearly, if that rumor is true. It would be interesting, to say the least.
How's your GraphTech doing?
My beloved GraphTech. I wonder how they are. The steel industry must be ripping right now.
Yep.
It's lower. That's the answer.
Well, I don't know. You never know. Oh, yep, it is. It's quite a bit lower.
I kind of like this analogy, but I think FanMag is a little bit like the Nifty 50. Nifty 50 was, they were all regarded as being like, you know, single decision stocks because they were so, the businesses were so high quality, growing so rapidly, also extremely expensive. And we went from Nifty 50 into the 70s when, you know, that was a value investor's market right there. So I kind of feel like there's something like that is going to happen here. I know I've said that a few times. Just want everybody to know what my biases are.
Yeah.
That's GraphTech. That's, it's not what you want to see.
It was, we got some high quality graphics in this show.
Six.
Well, that's the one. So that's one of those weird paradoxical things to me where the lower the price goes, the bigger the risk actually because of the take under problem. So if it normally the lower the price, the less risk that you're taking. But in that situation, I think your problem of getting taken under makes me afraid. Every tick down is a tick up in risk for me.
Do you guys did you guys see Munger's comments on Amazon having to worry about Costco?
Think Munger likes Costco a bit too much. I love me some Costco. I'm not trying to like shit on Costco, but Amazon doesn't have to worry about Costco.
Well, they provide totally different things. Like Costco is a core set of things that you want to buy. And then, you know, Amazon is the long tail of all the random shit that you would end up buying. And you don't want to like work that hard for it to show up at your door.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when Costco has the infrastructure, the internet attached to it, then maybe Amazon can worry about it. But
so here's a good question. And Bill, you might want to, as a seller of Berkshire, Chuck Akri sold a huge amount of Berkshire in his latest filing. How do you feel about that?
I own 7% of my portfolios in Berkshire, first of all. So I'd like, I'm
but
still
sold
tied
down
to the DLG. Stuff got cheap. I mean, you know, it got cheaper. I don't know. Somebody responded to me that they thought that, I mean, it was a small position anyway. But Akri, I mean, he, you know, to have a spot in the portfolio means something with Akri. I don't know, man. I think people bail on the old dog right before he shows his last trick. I think Buffett's still got one up his sleeve.
What it shows you is
I think it's going to take a while.
There's nobody will give you the benefit of the doubt, even if you crush it and become the richest man in the world of your entire career. They're still going to second guess you.
No, that's not it, man. It's just the size. It's the size of the entity. I mean, like Berkshire Hathaway Energy just announced some billion-dollar deal. It's going to be awesome. It doesn't really move the needle.
No, but they're bitching about not enough buybacks or pulling the trigger on in March. No, they're definitely coming at the king.
You never get the benefit of the doubt ever.
And I don't buy it.
Look, I'm an apologist, right? I mean, I don't think he's missed what he's actually waiting for. I just think he's playing a different game.
That's fair.
I don't think he's sitting there, you know, at the end of his career being like, oh boy, I can just do this buyback. It's going to be the greatest thing ever. Like that dude's waiting for like real pain, I think.
Well, I think we've come up on time, fellas. Any closing comments?
I feel like we'd shortchanged the Q&A session a little bit.
Yeah, let's do a couple more questions. Come on. Come on, Toby. I know you're not going anywhere.
I'm running out
unless
of...
Unless there's no engagement.
There's no questions.
There's lots of
actually,
there's lots
what
of comments.
Really to say is no one cares anymore.
There's lots of comments.
Jump the shark.
Okay. Who are the people to follow now that are better than Buffett?
Here's my list. Nothing. There's nothing on there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Akri. I think you follow Akri if you like that kind of stuff. But I don't think anybody's bigger than the king. I just think the king got so rich that the opportunity set shrunk on him.
Still a great business. Still run by the world's greatest capital allocator. Still high return on invested capital, just got too much cash on the balance sheet, and that problem's going to be solved in, I would say, the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, and the other thing is, even if it takes, let's say that you know, the bull case takes off and whatnot, I mean, let's say he does a big buyback in 12 months, it's going to be suboptimal. But, like, I don't know, the way that they look at that business, it's you're not going to be starving if that's the outcome. The rest of your portfolio is probably done fine, and that stock's going to do fine too. And you're going to do a hell of a lot better than bonds. So as like a wealth preservation machine, it's a pretty darn good one.
Berkshire's going to do better than the S&P 500 over the next decade,
I hope.
Cheaper, growing faster, or at least as fast, better balance sheet.
Better cap allocation.
Better cap allocation. I don't know if you can rely on that for the next decade, but I do think that that's true for I hope the whole lot, but for the near term.
Berkshire Hathaway Energy is freaking legit. I mean, again, you're paying a lot for it, but like, it's worth a lot. And I know that utilities is not what's going to get young people super amped up, but that's a hell of a good one.
Well, what would you pay right now for a magic box that you could put your money into and it would give you a 10% return for the next 10 years?
Quite a bit.
That's
although
basically,
if you paid
what,
too much, you wouldn't get your 10%. That's the nature of this game. But
yeah,
is
that what you're asking?
What
like,
you're
what guaranteed return do you need before you?
Well, I'm just saying that he has basically that in Berkshire Energy and the railroad, and those are really valuable, I think, in these kind of times where expected returns probably should be tamped down from here. And if you have a regulatory 10% that you can plow billions of dollars into, that's a pretty, he's playing a different game. It's a good game.
Yeah, well, and he's, I mean, it's not direct exposure to tech, obviously, but a lot of those data centers and stuff, Berkshire Hathaway Energy is like, as they get built, Berkshire Hathaway Energy supplies the energy. I mean, it's,
let me ask,
you know,
in a different
way.
You got a good
utility.
Would you take a guaranteed 10% return right now for the next 10 years and not touch anything else and just take that 10%?
The rational part of me would say, yeah, that'd be great. And then I know myself, so I would have to touch other things. I like the game too much. I can't not touch anything. Like,
Toby, what about you? Could you be chased and take a 10% from here for the next 10 years and call it a,
kind of think I can do better.
Wow. All right.
I think it's going to be close.
10% for 20 years, I'd be pretty okay. Like, that would be nice.
10 for 20 you would take.
Yeah. I'd take 10 for 10, but I'm just saying, you know, if we're playing the game, let's keep going with it.
All right.
On that note,
take care, everyone. Enjoy the outro music.
Stay safe.
Thanks, folks. Next time. Move with the rhythm. Shake it up. Stop when the clock hits 13. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4. Cut, cut, cut.